Let's look a little bit more closely at home foreclosures in the United States. We have a study here from the state that leads the nation in home repossessions, that is Nevada. The study shows that almost one in four homeowners who could have afforded to make their mortgage payments deliberately chose to walk away. In other words, some people who accept home foreclosures could have avoided them. That's one finding of a study commissioned by the Nevada Association of Realtors. The lead author is Joel Searby. His research firm, SGS, interviewed 1,000 people for the report.
It's a financial decision that these folks are making for their family, their best interest. They look at the value of their home and what they owe on it, and they say, this just doesn't make sense for me. Certainly there are secondary factors. One of the most important, in my opinion, is that the stigma has been lifted as it relates to walking away from a mortgage, whereas 20 years ago, this may have been something that would be considered shameful. Many people now are not only embracing it, but they're actually being facilitated by outside folks.
Facilitated?
Yeah, you have websites like youwalkaway.com and lawyers and others who are engaging in a practice of actually helping people decide to walk away and then walking them through the steps to do that.
What are some of the situations you encountered where people said it was better for them to walk away from the house even though they could pay and even though they were going to wreck their credit?
Let me share a story of one lady who was in her 60s. She was recently divorced, and as she looked at the rest of her life in a large home by herself that she could never sell for what it was worth, she simply said, this does not make sense to me. And so she was not concerned about being able to buy another home she could rent. She wasn't concerned about having a car. She already had a nice car. She wasn't concerned about getting credit. She had plenty of income. And she simply said, I'm going to walk away.
Did you hear that woman in a focus group?
Yes, I spoke with her personally in the focus group.
What did other people in the room say when she told that story?
Most of them were nodding their heads. These folks understand the same kind of situations that she was facing. Another man who was sitting next to her was actually a former home builder, but his entire financial situation added up to it made more sense for him to walk away than it did for him to stay in that home.
Who was it exactly among the various kinds of homeowners you had who did walk away?
Well, we found that a much larger proportion of those who walked away were the older homeowners, which was very interesting to us because we assumed that older homeowners would have a much stronger stigma culturally against walking away from their mortgage, when in fact it was the opposite. They were looking at the end of their life and their last 15 or 20 years and saying, this doesn't make sense for me to continue to pay this mortgage. And that was really a surprising finding. The younger folks were actually, in my opinion, quite a bit more tenacious in trying to reach out to these lenders and find out more information, whereas some of these older folks just simply said, I don't have the energy or the time to deal with this, in addition to the fact that the finances didn't make sense, and they walked away.
I feel like one of the lessons of this is how difficult it is to generalize. You are telling us that there are people who deliberately walk away from their mortgages, which is not what you would assume, but even in that subculture of people who walk away, it sounds like there are people who do it for good reason and people who do it for not so good reasons.
There's no doubt that many of these folks have gut-wrenching decisions to make, and while the general public may look at that and say, how could they walk away from their mortgage, these folks are facing very, very tough times in their personal lives. Many of them had unexpected bills. 12% of those we surveyed had a death in the family within the 6 months before the foreclosure. That's a significant number of people dealing with significant life events.
You said the stigma has been lifted. Has the news been a factor in that? And by that, I mean, it seems that there are a lot of, you could argue that there are a lot of bankers, for example, who got bailed out, people who are accused of having walked away with fortunes from this whole financial mess.
Well, there's no doubt that those who have been through foreclosure personally, the number one entity that they blame are banks and lenders. And so there definitely is a situation where you have homeowners pitting themselves against the lending institutions, and absolutely the news that they hear is these banks are being bailed out, and why would I continue to pay when they're getting bailed out? I'm not getting bailed out.
Joel Searby, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
He's with the research firm SGS.
In the midst of the uprising in Egypt, foreign oil companies there are evacuating their staffs and shutting down some operations. If this is anything like past disruptions in the Middle East, it will probably mean higher oil prices. Oil is trading above $100 a barrel in London for the first time since prices spiked in 2008. We'll talk more about oil prices in a few minutes. First, NPR's Jeff Brady reports on how the unrest in Egypt is affecting the oil industry.
Among big oil companies, BP has the largest presence in Egypt. It's been operating there for more than four decades. The company evacuated two plane loads of expatriate staff, and it shut down new drilling as a precaution. Production has not been affected yet, though. Like every other oil company contacted for this story, BP declined to talk in detail about the current situation in Egypt. Amy Myers Jaffe is director of energy research at Rice University's Baker Institute. At times like this, even if protesters aren't targeting oil companies, Jaffe says staying mum often is the best strategy.
You don't want to call attention to the location or the number of people that might become a target.
Jaffe says oil companies know how to operate in hostile climates. They do it all over the world. They often keep safe houses, like spy agencies do, and they always have evacuation plans for their workers. The point is, they know how to survive, even in difficult political climates. So, Jaffe says, during turmoil like what Egypt is experiencing, it's important for companies to play their cards close to the vest.
Being patient and see what happens is always a good philosophy. Because you just don't know how it's going to turn out.
Or who the company will have to work with next if someone else takes control of the country. Jaffe says for the world market, the petroleum that comes out of Egypt is not all that significant. But the country is an important transportation hub for Middle Eastern oil and gas. About 2% of the world's crude travels through the Suez Canal and a nearby pipeline. Both are shortcuts from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. Bhushan Bari is a senior director at IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He says without that shortcut, the price of transportation goes up.
Then the tankers will have to go around the Cape of Good Hope. That's about 6,000 miles extra and takes more time, money, and cost.
Bari says so far there's been no interruption in oil moving through the canal or the pipeline, but he says even if there were, others in the region could easily make up the lost petroleum.
OPEC countries have a lot of spare capacity, about 5 million barrels a day, which is far more than goes through Egypt.
Bari says what makes most people anxious is the prospect of unrest in Egypt spreading to nearby oil-producing countries like Libya and Algeria to the west or Saudi Arabia and Iran to the east. Just as sure as turmoil in the Middle East pushes up prices, it also prompts calls for more drilling in the U.S. On Tuesday, Alaska Senator Mark Begich said, quote, "The instability in Egypt underscores our need to expand our domestic energy production." Dan Weiss with the Center for American Progress says he could have predicted that would happen.
No matter what the problem, big oil and its allies only have one solution, which is drill, baby, drill. When all big oil has is a drill, everything looks like a well.
Weiss has his own axe to grind. He says the Egypt situation should prompt the U.S. to focus on reducing oil consumption and producing more environmentally friendly sources of energy. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Many Americans who lost their jobs in recent years are looking to replace their lost income with home-based businesses. Think Tupperware, Avon, Pampered Chef. But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, making real money is real work.
When Cindy Tisdale was laid off from her job as a transaction tax analyst, she started looking for new work right away.
The niche that I'm in tax law is so small that there's hardly any positions anywhere.
Then a former coworker, who also lost her job, started selling jewelry for Silpata Designs. It's a direct sales company where reps hold jewelry parties. Tisdale thought it sounded like a pretty good deal.
I did like, and I love tax law, which sounds really nerdy, you know, because I'm an, you know, my degree's in accounting and statistics. But I'm just like, you know what? Okay, maybe this is a midlife crisis. I don't know, but time to change. I want to do something that's fun.
So on a recent Saturday night, she brought a bunch of catalogs and jewelry samples to a friend's house for a small party. There was wine and cheese and shopping.
I like those. There's rings, a necklace, and a bracelet. I believe a bracelet.
Tisdale is still searching for a full-time job, but she's hoping she'll be so successful selling jewelry, she won't need one.
A lot of my faith and hope is on this right now at this point. I feel like I can do this. I know I can do this. This is my dream to, you know, work for myself. This is what it is. I want to work for myself.
There are a lot of newly minted salespeople out there, just like Cindy Tisdale. Silpata CEO Jerry Kelly says his company's sales force has grown by 7,000 since the start of the recession. And many of the new reps were looking to replace lost income.
When you have car payments, when you have mortgage payments, those payments don't wait until you get another job. And the best part about this is you can't be fired.
Silpata says its representatives make an average of $285 per party. With any of these direct-selling, home-based businesses, it's difficult to replace a full-time income, says Neil Offen. He's the president and CEO of the Direct Selling Association, a national trade group.
Anyone who says it's easy is lying. It could be fun, and it could seem easy, but it's not.
Of the more than 16 million people in direct sales in the U.S., he says only about 8% do it full-time. Half of them are making $50,000 a year, and fewer than 1% of direct sales representatives earn $100,000 or more.
To make six figures, or even the $50,000 level, come on, it's going to be hard work. Very hard work.
Or in other words, this isn't a get-rich-quick situation. Gabrielle Schwartz ran up against that reality when she joined a company that sells green home products.
I failed at just getting people to reply on email or phone, or I've met strangers that said they would do appointments and then they cancel when you confirm.
Schwartz lost her job at a St. Louis marketing firm more than 2 years ago when the company downsized. She initially thought this home-based business would be able to replace her old job. Now she's just hoping someday it may be a source of vacation money. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Today, President Obama will tour energy efficiency laboratories at Penn State University. It's part of his campaign to create jobs by promoting clean energy. Clean energy would also help to reduce greenhouse gases and fight climate change. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, you wouldn't know that by listening to the president.
President Obama is pushing a new clean electricity standard as a way to put Americans to work. He announced it in last week's State of the Union address.
Now, clean energy breakthroughs will only translate into clean energy jobs if businesses know there will be a market for what they're selling. So tonight, I challenge you to join me in setting a new goal. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources.
Experts say depending on the details, the proposal could slash greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector by as much as 50%, and power plants are the nation's biggest source of global warming pollution. But the president isn't selling the program that way. In the State of the Union, he didn't mention climate change, global warming, or greenhouse gases. The environmental impact of the proposal wasn't included in fact sheets passed out by the White House. Nor has the president mentioned it in speeches about clean energy since then. Jonathan Lash is the president of World Resources Institute, an environmental think tank.
It appears that he has concluded that it's not politically useful at this point to talk about climate change. I'm disappointed. We face an urgent threat from climate change, and we need to talk about it as a nation.
The details of the president's proposal aren't out yet. What is clear is that the president wants to include natural gas, nuclear power, and clean coal to lure Republican support for the proposal. That also explains why he's downplaying the impact on climate change. David Kreutzer from the Heritage Foundation is a critic of the president's climate policy. Kreutzer says however the president characterizes his clean electricity standard, it is a climate change policy.
To me, it's pretty obvious that's what they're going after, even though they don't want to say the word because I guess they've done polling that shows, you know, it doesn't help their cause.
Mark Mehlman is a Democratic pollster who concentrates on environmental issues. He says the president is right to focus on jobs instead of environmental benefits.
It's smart communication and it's smart politics. It's smart communication because putting this issue in the framework of jobs, where it properly belongs, responds to what is the number one concern of the American public. And it's smart politically, because it's much more likely to get attention from Congress if it's framed in terms of jobs than if it is framed in any other way.
Other efforts by the Obama administration to fight climate change are getting lots of attention from the new Congress. Republicans are pushing bills to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from regulating greenhouse gases. Cory Gardner is a new Republican member of Congress from Colorado. He wants to block the EPA from regulating greenhouse gases, but he's interested in the president's clean electricity standard because it includes natural gas, nuclear power, and clean coal.
I'm excited that he is willing to have that conversation and look forward to working with the administration and my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to advance an energy policy for this country that really does put more energy on the table instead of taking energy off the table.
But using a broad definition of clean power creates other problems. Environmental groups are vowing to fight the president's electricity standard if it promotes coal and nuclear power. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.